Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Florida Republican Kat Kamak, who joins us to discuss her home state's recovery from Hurricane Ian. But first, here's this week's headlines. California's Proposition 12 took center stage before the Supreme Court this week. The law has been approved by California voters and requires all pork, egg, and veal producers to meet specific animal housing standards to sell into the state. Justices peppered attorneys on both sides of the debate with tough questions as they worked to balance the rights of California citizens to regulate products on their shelves with the concerns farmers have offered about interstate commerce. FDA officials pledged to work toward reducing diet-related diseases by taking steps that will give consumers more information on what they're eating and pressure companies to reformulate products. FDA Commissioner Robert Califf says some in the food industry are misinforming consumers about the healthfulness of their products. As part of the White House's national strategy for eliminating hunger and reducing diet-related diseases, the FDA intends to develop regulations for front-of-pack labeling and set new longer-term targets for reducing sodium in foods. And finally, USDA trimmed its production expectations across several commodities. Soybeans, corn, and cotton totals were dropped in Wednesday's reports as economists looked to get a better handle on what will be headed to markets during this year's harvest. When compared to 2021, soybean production is expected to be down 3%. Corn is anticipated 8% lower, and USDA thinks cotton production will fall 21% this year. The changes largely come on lower yield expectations, as USDA left acreage estimates alone for corn and soybeans month over month. Tucked away in Wednesday's crop production report are figures painting a grim picture for orange production, and that's before Hurricane Ian ripped through the state. Based on information prior to the hurricane, USDA dropped Florida's all-orange forecast 32%. Florida Republican Kat Kamak has been assessing the damage in her home state since the storm made landfall and says recovery will be a long process.
I was down there this week seeing firsthand from an aerial view, but also boots on the ground, just exactly the extent of damage. And it's not just the water, right? We've had tremendous flooding, standing water, and salt water that has been absolutely devastating. But the wind damage to some of our groves, it's pretty awful. And something that was a little shocking to me was really how much the landscape has changed in terms of the damage. It's not just, you know, a culvert that needs to be replaced here and there. I mean, some of the groves have been completely flooded out to where we're having to bring in fill dirt and really rebuilding these tracks. And so it's going to be a total infrastructure overhaul in some areas. It's not just fruit on the ground. It's not just crops that aren't viable anymore. It's going to be a tremendous amount of effort to rebuild really from start to finish in some areas. I think from the federal level, what we need to be cognizant of is that the FSA structure was already strained and a little bit frustrating is a polite way to put it for so many of our producers. And so really working to make sure that we're having an appropriate response and an all-encompassing response. There's so many people that I remember from Hurricane Michael that they were shocked at how low the estimates were for damage. And when we went and dug into it, they hadn't included things like pivots or fencing or, you know, basic things that, you know, our producers are extraordinarily cognizant of the price of. But, you know, for folks in Washington, they weren't thinking about these things. They were just thinking about crop loss. And so I think when we're talking about the federal response, it's going to be an all-encompassing number when it comes to our producers. And like I said so many times before, agriculture is not something that, you know, you can turn on like a light switch. I was speaking with some of our dairies, and they were really sustaining tremendous losses from being down for 12 hours. And so having people who understand what all goes into these operations is going to be key, and really working to try to get ahead of some of these preliminary numbers is going to be a big, big fight.
Well, and as we talk about numbers, I assume that Congress is going to need be stepping in with some level of supplemental disaster assistance program. And I assume you and your Florida colleagues would like it yesterday as opposed to tomorrow. But is that something you anticipate Congress is going to be addressing here here yet in 2022? Or is that something that's going to need to be perhaps more fully assessed and distributed in the 2023 by Congress?
I would like to see a full assessment before, you know, we see a supplemental come before Congress. And some people are saying, I can't believe you would say that. Well, reason being is, you know, from 10 years of experience in navigating Florida politics and disaster relief, we've seen where we've seen had numbers come up so woefully short that it really doesn't even begin to scratch the surface. And so much of this damage we're not going to really see until, you know, weeks and months down the road. A great example is, you know, of course, there's fruit on the ground right now if we're talking about our citrus industry, but a lot of the stems were broken, and you're going to see that fruit rot off. And how much were these trees saturated with water? How viable are they going to be moving forward? We won't know the full extent until, you know, really months down the road. And so a supplemental is in the works. The key for us in Congress is going to be having a clean supplemental funding bill. There was a lot of misconception here recently that the continuing resolution that was put forward included funding for Hurricane Ian relief. That's just simply not true. For example, the money that was allocated for FEMA, actually $2 billion with a B, was going to unaccompanied children at the border. There was money going towards administrative expenses in Washington. But not once was Hurricane Ian mentioned in that bill. And I think that that's a common misconception that so many people have been frustrated with, particularly amongst the Florida delegation, that there was money for Hurricane Ian victims. There wasn't. So absolutely a supplemental bill is in the future. And I think that's going to be very much needed. But the political side of it, and I'll just be honest, it's if folks on the other side want to try to attach supplemental expenditures to it that have nothing to do with hurricane relief, that's when things are going to get very, very sticky in Washington.
We'll be right back to discuss the Farm Bill with Congresswoman Kamak right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of our space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Every morning, American corn farmers roll their sleeves up and start the work of growing a better future, one bushel at a time with America's crop. A better future made possible by their unmatched sustainability practices and the extraordinary benefits and uses of corn throughout the global economy. And the National Corn Growers Association proudly supports and advocates for all they do, year in and year out.
Welcome back. Hurricane Ian has shown a spotlight on the debate of whether or not to include permanent disaster language for agricultural producers in the upcoming Farm Bill. For Congresswoman Kamak, she says that's one of several things she'd like to see addressed before the upcoming legislation is drafted.
The problem is that for the last 21 months and sitting on House Agriculture, the conversations have really been centered around a Green New Deal energy type of discussion. I remember some of the last few committee hearings that we've had, they were discussing putting electric vehicle charging stations in rural America. And meanwhile, we're just trying to get broadband. You know, these are some of the frustrating things, is that there's just a real lack of cohesive direction between Republicans and Democrats. I think that both sides has very specific ideas of what the future of agriculture looks like. And when we're doing markups in committee that are to the tune of $90 billion, and they can't even account for 20 of it, yet they pass it anyways, that's really frustrating, particularly coming from a state like Florida, where we have over 300 specialty crops. You know, we're the number two in the nation for cow-calf producers, and we're such a big ag state, and none of our needs have been met. And I'm really frustrated about the fact that we have seen pretty horrific outcomes here. Just yesterday, you know, the USDA announced what our yields, projected yields for citrus industry would be. I mean, we've got to do some serious investments in precision agriculture, high-tech ag, really get into the root of our broken labor system, address the supply chain. The regulatory environment, of course, is killing us. And then you look at the tax structure. We've got some major issues that we've got to address. And so going into the Farm Bill, that's going to be top of mind for us. And hopefully we will have the majority, we'll be able to drive that very aggressive ag-minded agenda and piece of legislation forward.
So you mentioned what you perceive as some shortcomings in terms of committee activity in this current Congress. Going forward then, as Congress looks to write a new Farm Bill, what do you see as some of the oversight gaps that you perhaps would like to see filled in this next Congress, some of the hearings that you would like to see before you and your colleagues write this next Farm Bill?
Oh my goodness. I don't know if the program's long enough to go over all the shortcomings that we need to address. I mean, I would say, you know, there's some really some really serious discussions that need to be had about our young farmers programs. You know, we talk a lot about the next generation of agriculture. And yet today, if you're a young farmer looking to get started, you have to have so much capital and it is so intensive that it's virtually out of reach. And none of the programs that USDA has put forward have really hit the mark in terms of really closing the gap between the next generation and the current generation. And the tax structure, as I've said, it doesn't facilitate the passing of the family farm. It makes it virtually impossible. So we have a lot of work to do in that space. I would say on the nutritional side, you know, of course, 80% of the Farm Bill is the nutritional programs like SNAP and EBT. The oversight has been severely lacking in that regard. I cannot tell you how many law enforcement investigations go on surrounding fraud and abuse within the program. And I'll be the first to go to bat for our farmers and say that our farmers produce because they don't want anybody to be hungry. We're the first to lend a hand when people are down. But we have seen absolute, just egregious waste, fraud, and abuse within these programs. And that needs to be investigated. People need to be held accountable. And that absolutely is going to be top of mind when we're talking about oversight. You know, and then there's so many programs that need to be updated. We could get into a pretty substantial conversation about the direct assistance programs that have gone awry in the past and how we need to streamline that and bring that up to, you know, to today's expectations. So I think oversight collectively is going to be a huge part of the goings on of the committee moving forward, not just putting together a Farm Bill, but really understanding the needs of, you know, 21st century agriculture and how we change that conversation, not just from, hey, this is the family farm, we feed our community, we feed our family, but ag is a national security concept that needs to be addressed as such. And so lots to do when it comes to the Farm Bill and the 118th Congress.
Lots to do in that piece of legislation. A lot of things for you and I to discuss down the road, and we'll look forward to that conversation the next time it takes place. But for now, Congresswoman, thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it. Have a good one.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel, but first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at where things stand on the trade front in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
New ag export numbers from the USDA show August was another month of record high exports. But imports are also soaring, leading to a negative trade balance so far this year. This chart shows calendar year numbers for U.S. exports and imports from 2018 to the year-to-date totals in 2022. Exports so far sit at $130 billion, while imports total $133 billion, giving the U.S. a current negative trade balance of nearly $3 billion. As you can see, there is a trade surplus in every prior year on our chart except for 2019, when there was a trade deficit. So far, several factors have been identified as contributing to this year's trade deficit. A strong U.S. dollar is creating a challenging environment for American agricultural exporters. Infrastructure issues are also causing problems. Lower water levels on the Mississippi River are slowing barge traffic and increasing freight rates. Corn, rice, and soybean exports are at low levels, but beef exports have been solid. According to the U.S. Meat Export Federation, beef exports have topped $1 billion in 7 of the first 8 months of 2022. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're going to be diving into legal issues that were the hot topic in Washington, D.C. this week, specifically the Proposition 12 arguments at the Supreme Court. Joined this week by Travis Cushman with the American Farm Bureau Federation, Brian Frizzell with the Constitutional Accountability Center, and Elizabeth Rumley with the National Agricultural Law Center. Appreciate all of you taking the time to join us. And Travis, I'm going to go to you first here, because prior to the arguments, I had the chance to hear from folks at both the American Farm Bureau and the National Pork Producers Council, the two lead plaintiffs in this particular case, and was basically got the opinion that Farm Bureau and NPPC felt pretty good about the case that they were bringing to the Supreme Court, and felt pretty good prior to oral arguments. Having heard oral arguments, how do you feel about that case at this point?
We feel very positive. You know, I think the justices seem to recognize that there was some very, very large issues at play here. This issue just doesn't relate to agriculture. Often agriculture cases are the big precedent-setting cases before the Supreme Court, and this is obviously going to be one of them. But, you know, I think the justices seem to recognize here that if California can regulate farming practices across the country, Texas can regulate whether or not its products are made by union labor, non-union labor. There's an infinite amount of different kinds of retaliatory legislation that could be passed across the country. And I think the justices seem to recognize that concern with Prop 12.
Well, and Elizabeth, as the justices get together and seek to make their decision, write that opinion, and we anxiously await that text. But as they look to work with each other on this, what does the court ultimately need to sort through as it looks to render its decision here?
Well, in short, the first question is going to be whether the Ninth Circuit had a problem or made an error in dismissing the case. And so that would be one way that the court can address it. But if they want to look at the bigger issues of whether this is a dormant commerce clause violation, whether it should stand, if it's constitutional, and what test should be applied, if it should be the Pike test that they were questioning about, or if it should be a different kind of test. Those are all big questions that they're going to be looking at, and that we may get answers to coming up in the beginning of next year.
Well, and procedurally, there was very, very little very, very little discussion about the fact that there was that procedural Ninth Circuit option that you mentioned. And Brian, bringing you into the fold here, I wonder then, is there any room for some kind of a middle ground decision that satisfies both parties? You know, maybe that procedural route could be a way to do that. Maybe that wouldn't satisfy everyone, but it wouldn't necessarily, offend anyone's sensibilities either. Or are they basically going to have to side one way or the other and leave one of the parties in this case a little bit frustrated?
Well, in one sense, the court will have to pick sides, because the lower courts dismissed the lawsuit. And so if the Supreme Court affirms that decision, then the case is over and California wins. But if the Supreme Court decides to revive the case and allow it to move forward, that would be a victory for the pork producers. But there are different ways that the court could do that, and it could allow some claims to go forward but not others. And so I do think there's a possible result in which we could see a narrow victory for the pork producers that allows one of their claims to move forward, but not the other claim. And just for context, remember that the pork producers essentially brought two arguments against Proposition 12. One is the idea that California is trying to regulate beyond its borders. Even though Prop 12 only affects sales within California, that the argument is that it will have practical effects that will extend beyond California. That's the most broad and far-reaching argument that the pork producers have raised in this case. Personally, I did not hear sympathy for that point of view from any of the justices during Tuesday's argument. But the pork producers do have a fallback argument. They have, under this Pike balancing test that was just mentioned, that essentially is a principle that says if a law can be overturned, if the burdens that it imposes on interstate commerce clearly outweigh the local benefits that it provides to the state. Essentially, this asks the court to kind of weigh the value of a law against its interference with interstate commerce. And I do think there's a possible result in which the Supreme Court could say, well, it was a little bit premature to dismiss that claim. We should let that claim move forward, allow the pork producers to try to prove their case about the effects of Proposition 12. That would require them, of course, to come up with evidence before the court. What would happen procedurally is that the case would go back down to the trial court. Both sides would present evidence, and the court would decide who was right about Proposition 12, possibly after a trial. And then you could have another appeal after that process is played out. And so you could see that result. That would be a narrow victory that I think you could call the middle ground. I don't think the pork producers might be very happy with that result, however. The Supreme Court has always said that when courts apply this kind of balancing test, they're supposed to be very deferential to state judgments. And so laws, state laws are almost never overturned under that balancing test. The last time the Supreme Court did that was in the 1980s, for example. So that shows just how rare it is.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
We kind of walked through a little bit, Brian did in his response there, Elizabeth, sort of some of the tenure of the room necessarily and how justices were reacting to the arguments made by both sides. I wonder, as you had the opportunity to watch those discussions or listen to them rather, what from the justices necessarily jumped out at you? And how do you think that might be influencing the final outcome that we'll see?
Well, a couple things. One, with the morality question that he discussed with the Pike balancing test, I think there was a lot of questions about what level morality should or would be considered in applying this test. And I think that that will be part of their discussions as they're moving forward. And second, I was really surprised, and it was interesting to see the amount of discussion from justices on both sides of the ideological spectrum to the entire argument. Justices all over the court posed some really difficult questions, some really substantive questions to both sides. And we talk a lot about how Supreme Court cases right now seem to be sort of split along that ideological break. And this might be one of those cases where we see justices come from both sides and we end up with several concurring opinions in making the ultimate judgment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Travis, I know that the American Farm Bureau Federation is, of course, a general farm organization, but it does count hog producers in its membership. And I wonder, as we look forward to a Supreme Court decision at some point here in the near future, wondering how should we expect the nation's hog producers to react and to move forward? Should the ruling maybe not go in favor of NPPC and the Farm Bureau, and maybe Prop 12 compliance is going to be mandated going forward?
That's a really tough question. Unfortunately, hog farmers generally aren't in the position of deciding where their pork, where their market hogs ultimately end up. And our big fear from American Farm Bureau's perspective is it's going to result in a lot of consolidation in the industry. It's going to be too difficult for small farms to be able to comply with this, to make these very, very expensive changes to their operations. And then also running the fear that, you know, if California is requiring 24 square feet per hog this year, next year Massachusetts might require 28 square feet, and another state might require 32 square feet, and create an impossible system for especially the smaller folks to be able to comply. So that's our big fear is that a loss here will result in further consolidation of the industry, and then this kind of tactic of these kinds of laws exporting values in other states will spread onto other areas of agriculture.
And Brian, I want to wrap things up with you here because you said in some comments in advance of these oral arguments that you used the term a dramatic expansion of the Commerce Clause should the justices side with the pork producers and the Farm Bureau in this particular case. And you said this could call into question a number of other state laws that might use not necessarily the same, but maybe similar authority. What kind of laws are coming to mind for you when you make an argument like that?
Well, in making that comment, I was mostly referring to the extraterritorial argument that the pork producers are making. The idea that even though California's Prop 12 only regulates sales of pork within California, that it's impermissibly controlling conduct in other states because, as a practical matter, the pork producers allege, the industry is going to react to Proposition 12 by changing its practices in a broader fashion. And The dangerous thing from my perspective is that that type of effect, that type of practical effect, has never been previously a grounds for invalidating a state law. Because anytime a state passes a law that has an effect on a nationwide industry, very often you're going to have these kinds of practical effects that reach into other states. So, you know, states protect their residents from all kinds of potential dangers, you know, food that's unsafe, consumer products that are dangerous, pollution, deceptive financial practices. And they also passed various laws that, you know, reflect the values of their residents. For example, many states require utility companies to use a certain percentage of renewable energy. Some states ban the sales of tissue from aborted fetuses. Other states, in order to protect wildlife, require that certain types of plastics be biodegradable. And states have always had wide leeway to pass these kinds of laws that reflect their values. But the
with all of that in mind, having seen the arguments and having had a little bit of time to digest them, do you think the justices will end up going there?
I think one of the things that they wrestled with during the argument on Tuesday is not necessarily Proposition 12 itself, but the how far a state could go in terms of banning products based on moral concerns about how those products were produced. That really seemed to be the issue that potentially troubled a number of justices, and it's it is a difficult issue. However, one of the things that discussion didn't focus as much on is that Proposition 12 has two bases. One is this moral concern about subsidizing pork from other that was raised inhumanely, but the other basis for the law is protecting against the risk of disease. And so I think it's natural that the justices focus during the argument on these very new and interesting and tricky issues. I mean, there's very smart people presented with an interesting question, and they have to think about the implications. Ultimately, though, as I mentioned before, I don't see the justices embracing the far-reaching arguments that the pork producers are making. At best, I could see them essentially trying to avoid those difficult issues by sending the case back down to the lower courts, perhaps letting this pike balancing claim move forward, which would allow the justices to not have to weigh into some of these tricky issues.
Well, we'll be keeping a very close eye on how the Supreme Court decides to weigh in on this decision. A number of things to consider, as the panel has mentioned, and we'll be sure to cover all of them here at AgriPulse.com. But for now, I appreciate all of our panelists taking the time to join us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, Hannah Pagel takes a look at global food insecurity in this week's Map It Out.
Food security around the world is headed in the wrong direction. In fact, new Department of Agriculture figures show global food insecurity has jumped almost 10% this year. USDA analyzes how food prices and income affect food demand in 77 lower-income countries around the world. This map shows the change in prevalence of food insecurity in 2022 compared to 2021. Almost 119 million more people are food insecure in those countries compared to last year. The increase can be attributed to two main factors: the COVID-19 pandemic, and Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which is reducing wheat and grain exports and fueling higher input costs. North Africa is the most affected region. It's expected to see a 25% increase in food insecurity. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the upcoming week. The FDA is hosting a stakeholder webinar Friday on the proposed changes to definitions of healthy on food labels. USDA is scheduled to release a handful of monthly reports, including offerings on milk production, livestock slaughter, and cattle on feed, as well as a quarterly report on rice stocks. As always, stay tuned to AgriPulse.com for all of this and more. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one. Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit agripulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.